All right, so we're joined today by men's golf coach Casey Luban. We've got a we're very blessed at Michigan State to have a men's golf program and a women's golf program that are both very, very good. And Casey leads the men's half of that duo. Casey, when you think about building a golf program, something you've worked very hard to do over the years, and you think about who you want to bring in as a recruit, and how you create that strong base. What are the things you're looking for? And obviously, if you're recruiting a golfer, they've got to be a good golfer. That's that's pretty obvious. But beyond that, what do you want in a person that you're bringing to campus?
Well, it's a good question. I think I could give you kind of more of the canned answer because there are five things we talk about every time. You know, and learning from Stacy and my coach, Mark Hankins, when I was playing here, you know, a lot of this came directly on how they recruited. But the first thing is character. You know, this program, I would venture to say, you could probably chime in here as well, spends more time with our donors, alumni, supporters than maybe any of our student athletes. And as because everybody plays golf, right? So as they do that, the character of the young people is on display as a representative of the entire athletic department. So we always start there, and then obviously they got to have the academic habits. One of the funny things when we talk about academics is sometimes the really smart kids who maybe weren't trained in high school have struggled a little more than the kids who went to a more demanding high school but had the study habits. So we always talk about study habits. And then when we start to get into their golf game, generally at this point, they 16, 17 years old, they have to be nationally competitive. A top 100 recruit's a pretty good guideline for the Big Ten and for our program. But sometimes, because golf is limited access depending on resources, we talk about a fourth category, which is do they have the potential to grow into that? In Michigan, there used to be more diamonds in the rough than there are, but there's still some out there. So if they're not nationally competitive elite, do they have the potential to grow into that? And then lastly, the tiebreaker, which always matters more than you think it's going to, is their love for the institution. You know, whether that's a kid who grew up in a Michigan State family, or in a couple cases on our team, a kid who grew up in a Buckeye family who wanted to do something different, and a kid who grew up in a Wolverine family who wanted to do something different. That love of the institution ends up being the tiebreaker a lot of the time.
But it's and sometimes to me that translates into the word fit.
Yeah.
And and it's interesting that I think when we one of the things I did recently was as athletic director is hire my first coach, and we hired a coach for our rowing program, and I discovered that as well. I didn't anticipate it, but one of the most critical factors was it in balancing a couple of people that were both well qualified was selecting the person that you thought would fit the or that I thought would fit the culture, the vibe, the understand the land grant spirit and mission, and what our values are here at Michigan State.
Absolutely. Well, I had a chance to have lunch with her last week, and she sure feels like a Spartan. We've only known her for an hour and a half, but referencing that, you know, one of the things that was different when I was an assistant coach here, 2004 to 2008, I felt like maybe there was more people on our staff that saw this as part of their career, not a destination. When I got back in 2011, I felt like there was a lot of people here who felt this was their dream job. I kind of look at that and go, well, I'm blessed. At this point, I have nine guys who really love this program. Maybe tomorrow something will happen, but you know, when you get the right fit, you hire the right person, you don't have that feeling of, okay, I've had a bad day, it's time for me to go. We had a bad day, but I love this place, we're going to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to shoot 81. You're going to fail an exam from time to time. Things are going to go bad. When you love the place, you fit for the place. You generally want to make it work.
So one of the unique struggles that you have is being a golf coach in a place where much of the year you could have multiple inches of snow on the ground. there could be winds whipping around at minus zero temperatures and the like, and yet you've got to compete with programs all over the country. So what? How do you make that work?
Yeah, so it's funny. I know Coach Slobodnik Stoll was on earlier. She doesn't like the W word. We don't use the W word, winter, when referring to recruiting. I've decided to go the other way. Let's just embrace it. We've got the best indoor facility that I know of in America. It's certainly in a conversation with two or three others. When we designed that short game area, we knew that the most important thing was how we chip and putt. You can pick up and go hit golf balls tomorrow anywhere in the world and be relatively similar to where you are inside. But chipping and putting is incredibly difficult to replicate in a northern climate. So I think of all the things in the facility that help us, that's A, number one. It's actually more difficult to chip on our indoor facility than it is outside. And it's usually the opposite. Indoor facilities, usually you can just kind of get away with. And you're a golfer, you get away with mishits. And ours, you don't get away with anything other than perfect shots. So we've got the facility to do it. The only challenge now is, 7,000 square feet is an amazing facility. But it does get stale after a while. You can only hit so many shots in that 8 to 10 week stretch. So we got to keep it fresh every day. Dan, our assistant coach, spends most of his time coming up with creative ways to practice so we don't hit the same shots over and over and over. And then lastly, we get him on a plane a lot on Friday. We fly to Naples, Florida, or Houston, Texas, wherever our donors are that support us, and play golf on the weekends down there. Just kind of break it up a little bit. When the NCAA changed the rule that we could travel without a competition, obviously it increased our budgets a little bit. But we built homes now, and with alumni and friends in Hilton Head, Naples, and Houston, Texas, where they plan on us every year to come down and practice for a couple of days. They support the team. All we pay for is to get there, and they host us. So between a combination of having the best indoor facility in America and getting on the road on the weekends, we make that time go pretty quickly.
So talking about your indoor facility a little bit, one of the things that you have, and I'm not going to get this exactly right, which is, I guess, why I'm asking the question, is you have this gizmo, this device that where a guy can hit a ball into a net functionally, and you can't, because the room's only say 15 foot long, you can't really tell where the ball's going to go, but after the guy hits the ball, then up on the computer pops all this data about the velocity of the club head and the angle of the impact and the spin on the ball and just sort of an extraordinary amounts of data, particularly for a guy like me for whom no fairway has been built wide enough. How does that help, and how do you use that technology?
First of all, give yourself some more credit. Angle of attack and spin rates, you're pretty close. TrackMan has become the Kleenex of the golf industry. It's where all the vernacular goes through. It became the brand that everybody uses. It's a $30,000 Doppler radar launch monitor. Everybody on tour, PGA Tour, carries one with them now. So we have three of them. We take them outside, and we have the one inside. What TrackMan has done is changed how we all coach. Because if I were to say to you, hey, Bill, this is what I think you're doing wrong with your swing. If I'm just saying that as an educator, you could question that. Well, how do you know that? This swing's moving 120 miles an hour. How can you pick that up? Well, now all I have to say is, here's what I think's going on. See, this evidence, the 38 numbers that show up every time you swing, have shown me that what I was saying was right. So from a coaching perspective, it became a lot simpler. One, teach them what the numbers mean. So now they can self-identify every shot and what goes wrong. Now I can teach them how to correct what we both know is going wrong. It can get a little overwhelming because there's a lot of data, and you can search for perfection, which is a rabbit hole that has ended a lot of careers. But without it, you can't compete in today's world. So the gizmo, which now I'm going to call it. I like that. The gizmo also allows us to do that with putting and play golf courses. We can bring donors in and go play 18 at Pebble Beach. Keeps it fresh once again.
You know, I'm going to take you back in time, probably close to 20 years. Mm-hmm. You made the decision to come to Michigan mm-hmm. State as a student athlete. Mm-hmm. A couple things about that. One, did you know that, hey, someday I want to be the head coach at Michigan State? And two, what is the, as you now compare your experience to your student athletes, you know, as you put yourself kind of in their shoes, you've been in their shoes, how does that make your job easier?
I don't know if it makes it easier. Sometimes I think it makes it clarifying. You know, my story is really unique. I was telling the guy who runs the Lansing Chamber of Commerce yesterday of this story, but when I came back to Michigan State, I went to Miami University in Ohio my first year, and they cut the men's golf program, and they've since saved it because I went back there to be a head coach a number of years later. But I came back to Michigan State because I wanted to work in politics. I know the boss and I share an affinity for politics and watching and studying. So I wanted to be a political aide. So I moved back to Michigan State because I was close to the Capitol. I worked in the 2000 election cycle. I just kept playing golf because I enjoyed playing. So when tryouts came my second year, I shot 73 or 4 in one day tryout, and a kid from Grand Rapids, Bobby Hughes, beat me by one. And Mark Hankins, the coach at the time, who's become one of my lifelong heroes, he cut me. So the next fall, I came back. I played tournaments, worked in politics all year, came back, tried out. I won, but I played about the same, 73 or 74, and he cut me. So now I figure, well, college golf is probably not for me. No big deal. About a month and a half later, he called and said, hey, we got a spot now. You want to be on the team? And that was October 20th of 2001. And I considered myself probably good enough to compete with the guys. A year later, I was the number one player. And, you know, you never know how that's going to work. You know, I think I'm the kind of guy that makes a lot of coaches look stupid. Like, how come we didn't recruit this guy? He's playing number one at Michigan State. Well, because we don't know. You know, I figured something out. I got an opportunity. I ran with it. So I play 3 years, have a great experience, and I'm getting ready to go back into politics. Lifelong dream. I got some friends in Washington. I'm going to go be a staffer. And Mark Hankins, my coach, says, hey, we really don't have an assistant coach. Would you like to do it? I said, well, what's it pay? $14,000. Well, $14,000. Yeah, nine-month contract, $14,000. I said, well, what do we do in the other 3 months? He said, well, we still recruit, but you just don't collect the salary. And somehow, he must be the best salesman in the world. He talked me into it. 6 months in, I knew that's what I was going to do. So when I was 22 or 23, my dream was I want to come back at some point and be the golf coach in Michigan State. And, you know, at 30, that happened for me. So I was very blessed. But the question about, you know, what I did and playing and how it affects my coaching, we always judge people by their actions, but we judge ourselves by our intentions. You know, like, you can have a little more sympathy for kids, you know, even when they have maybe actions that you don't approve of because you were in those shoes not that long ago. So I try and be a little more understanding on some things, but I also spend a lot more time pleading with them about the little things that I missed, you know, the tiny things that made a bigger impact. Like, when I was a student, I didn't really know any of our supporters or a lot of the staff members, so I'm constantly engaging them in that. I spent too much time working on my golf swing and not enough time chipping and putting. So you can always refresh those stories, you know, and especially with our associate head coach, Dan Ellis. He was a GAM Player of the Year this year, best amateur player in the state of Michigan. So his experience is the same. He played for me. He can talk about the mistakes he made. It's really unique with Stacy, Caroline, Dan and I, all four of us played at Michigan State, only school in the country, and our experiences weren't that long ago. It's pretty special.
Golf is such a fascinating sport because it's more than many sports we have on campus, at least, technology-driven. Mm. So if you look at basketball or football, there certainly have been some changes in football and the equipment and in helmets. Basketball, less so. But in golf, the technology over the last 20 years, the design of the ball, the design of the club head, have really changed massively, and that then players can hit the ball significantly further mm-hmm. than than an Arnold Palmer could have generations
sure.
ago. And then that impacts things like course design and length of hole and that kind of thing. Good, bad, would you or does it not matter to you?
Good for a while. It's getting to the point now where we've reached our limit technology-wise. It can't make the club heads any faster or any bigger. We got all the swing gadgets and tools to use to refine ourselves. The bad part is golf really started to decline around 2008-09. The numbers show we're starting to get out of that cycle, but we went on a 10-year stretch where the game really didn't grow. When Tiger came out, everybody thought, well, this is going to increase inner city, underprivileged participation, minority participation. It actually went the other way. The game became more popular, got way more expensive, and we shut off access to a lot of people. Because of that, we kind of paid for 10 years. As the country clubs got older and those people started to pass away, there wasn't this youth influx of people to grow our game. The money that was left, they all saw the problem on the wall and said, hey, this golf ball is going way too far. Our proud course is now obsolete. Let's put $6, $7, $8 million into rebuilding this thing. And so a lot of them failed because they didn't have the revenue to support that. So as we get to this point now, from a competitive standpoint, the PGA Tour has got to be getting close now to creating their own rules. For guys who play at a 10 handicap, let's let the ball go far. Let's let the driver go as fast. But for the PGA Tour now, you can make a golf course 8,300 yards long. That's not what stops them.
See, I've always thought that my kind of bizarre theory of this has been that when you take baseball, for example, if you're a high school kid, we'll let you hit an aluminum bat.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get to the majors, you got to hit a wood bat.
Yeah.
And it's always struck me the analogy for golf might be, you can hit that. That aluminum or the metal club head that looks like a golf club for a clown. It's so big.
Mm.
But if you're if you get to the PGA level, maybe you have to hit a persimmon wood or maybe you have to hit a ball that's been designed of the 70s era, the 80s era, and not to have so much spring that it goes an extra 100 yards with the same swing. And and I've always thought that that would then allow the amateur, the weekend golfer, who maybe is capable, but obviously not truly gifted professional, to feel more kinship with those folks.
Yeah, absolutely.
And maybe allow the game to grow.
You're spot on. We call it bifurcation. To me, the simplest solution, the manufacturers are the ones who shut this down, right? Because even a rookie on the PGA Tour, we have a guy who I coach on the PGA Tour, Ryan Brehm, played for me. He's not a household name. He might be in East Lansing, but not elsewhere. Even a rookie on the PGA Tour gets an equipment contract that's well over $100,000 a year, probably closer to $200,000. Because people will buy the clubs that any tour player plays. So they always shut this down and say, we're not going to build something just for tour players. We want Bill Beekman to be able to play the driver that Tiger Woods plays. And we're going to sell a lot more because he's playing Tiger's driver. The reality is all they'd have to do is make the golf ball 0.06 inches bigger. Okay, so the golf ball's 1.62 inches. If we made it 1.68, all the data would show that that would scale the game back enough. A bigger golf ball spins more, so it curves into the woods more, spins more into the wind and downwind and crosswind, so it's harder to control. And it goes about 10 to 12% shorter. That's a simple solution, but getting the manufacturers to make golf balls at a great expense to them for a bunch of guys they have to give them to for free that you can't buy in a shop, it's a hard argument to win.
Yeah.
You're not going to walk in and say, I want to play the ball Tiger's playing. It's going to make me 20 yards shorter and more crooked, but since he plays it, I want to play it.
Right.
That's where we keep hitting the roadblock. Eventually, they're going to have to stop.
Well, you take courses, classic courses like Augusta or Pebble Beach or St. Andrews even a layperson would have a working knowledge of. They can't make them longer. they can only sort of grow the rough so long that you can only trick it up so much before some other solution has to be out there.
And our turf guys would tell you, maintaining conditions like that are incredibly expensive and incredibly difficult. So to make your, if you can't make it longer to make it harder and you can't grow the rough up, they go the other way. They make everything really short and really fast. Well, that's awesome. We love it. But you can't afford to maintain your local golf course that way.
So you're putting on a piece of glass.
Yeah.
So
a normal stimp meter reading on the PGA Tour is like 11 to 12. These greens are over 14.
So all this talk about too far, too short, everything. I think one of the things that's still neat about golf is you're watching the President's Cup, and it comes down to can a guy make a 5-foot, 8-foot putt when there's a low pressure on the line. You know, at that point, none of those analytics save you. You know, you're just dealing with your, you know, what's in your head. And I think that's the unique part about golf, maybe compared to other sports. You know, football, they talk about, oh, a kicker, you know, can he get, like, you know, it becomes mental. Mm-hmm. You know, at different sports, maybe when you're shooting a free throw, it becomes mental or whatever. But some of the stuff, like, over a round of golf, like, you're thinking every shot.
Yeah.
You know, you can have all the talent in the world. How do you teach that mental part of the game?
Well, it's funny because that's 90% of our instruction, 90% minimum. You know, physical instruction with a track man, they know where they're going. I just got to help them get there. To be honest with you, with this generation, this has really evolved. We used to subscribe to the theory that everybody should be thinking the same things mentally. This guy named Bob Rotella wrote like 6 to 8 books maybe 20 years ago, and they became like the Bibles for golf mental training. Everyone was recycling everything he said. And then it took us about 15 years. We went, well, wait a minute. If you're a good putter, I shouldn't change your putting stroke. If you're good mentally, why am I putting these thoughts in your head that are troublesome? So first thing is identifying if it is really a mental problem and what that is. Does it come from anxiety? Does it come from sometimes a fear of success? Does it come from wanting to keep your spot in the lineup? That's our first challenge. Why are they feeling anxious? And then secondly, then you can give mental, I would say, performance tips that have worked, but physical tips always provide more comfort than mental tips. So if they struggle from 5 feet because they get jumpy, generally a physical reaction happens. So we try and give them the physical solution, which also becomes a mental solution. Like if they pull 5-footers because they get nervy and their left hand backs up, then we give them something to fix it physically, which they don't even see is really a mental solution. Now I can't hit the shot that my mental problems cause because I got a physical. So all day long with our tour player especially, we're giving them physical cues that really solve mental issues. And secondly, you know, as it's evolved with these guys, I used to worry 10 years ago that my guys were groggy and lazy and sleeping too much. I spend all my time now worrying if they're going to have the mental energy to get through the day because they don't sleep enough. It's the greatest change I've seen in coaching. I used to, you know, guys would be at dinner 10 years ago and they'd be falling asleep at the table. Now I rush them through dinner. I get them back to the hotel. They wear a special set of eyeglasses every night. We do 10 minutes of meditation. Anything we can do to get them to actually sleep. Because when they do that, they're able to handle the mental hurdles, the mental battle every shot. They don't get physically tired anymore. These kids are strong. They're fit. They get mentally tired a lot faster than they used to.
In your role as a head coach of a D1 program, there's a lot more to coaching than just coaching. So in your role as head coach, what are the kinds of things that you do during the day that might surprise people in terms of the role of a head coach?
Yeah, it's an interesting evolution. I wish there was, I think that the title kind of betrays what we do a little bit because, you know, about 10 to 15% of my actual time at work is in instruction. 50% of my time in certain points of the year is fundraising and alumni development and program building. You know, facility stuff, raising money for our program, engaging our alums, raising money for the department, trying to be helpful there. That's 50% of my time on a standard week. And then all the little things, like we were designing a facility and talking about soil samples yesterday. Yeah, when we built the building, I remember having an hour meeting about the HVAC unit. Like, I don't know if Tom Izzo has meetings about his HVAC unit. I'm going to guess not. You know, and responding to so many different things that right now I'm doing a thing called Amos meetings with my players, trying to spend an hour with them talking about anything other than golf, because that's really important to this generation. So we kind of wear a lot of hats, the equipment piece, designing and figuring out equipment. We do a ton of research. Recruiting, obviously, a huge part of our lives, a little smaller part of my life than maybe my assistant coach's life. But there's a lot of things going on.
Talk a little bit about your fall season and looking ahead to the spring season. I know your fall, you had some good success, others that you were frustrated, you know, kind of up and down. You know, James Pyatt played really well and won a couple of tournaments. Where do you see things going in the spring now?
Good question. So this is unusual. When we built this thing, so we've been to four straight NCAA tournaments, school record. The first 3 years of that run, we were so good in the fall. Like, the spring became kind of like, hey, let's keep going. We'll prepare ourselves for the championship, but we look like we're going to get an NCAA bid. Last year, we had a really shaky fall, and we did something that's never happened in college golf, where a northern team moved over 20 spots in the spring. Very hard to do, right? You're playing against southern schools on their courses at their time of year. We moved up huge. We're going to kind of have to do it again because we've had another fall that I thought was sloppy. We got one of the best players in the Big Ten, number two guy in the Big Ten. We had to put two new guys in the lineup, and you never know how it's going to go. Right now, they look like they're bona fide Big Ten contributors. This fall, they didn't. So I think we're going to be fine. I think we're going to make a fifth straight NCAA tournament. We're going to play NCAA regionals here at home. But we're going to have to be good week in, week out. Nothing surprised us really other than we were just a little more inconsistent. In the fields we play in now, well, you got to be good every week. We're going to be fine. We had a great offseason. Did all the structural work on our golf swings, did the structural work on our body. And what is really happening now, I talked about mental fatigue. These kids play golf from January 15th until November 1st as hard as they can. Because when they leave here in May, they go home and they play as hard as they can all summer. We saw a lot of mental fatigue this fall. Even James Pyatt, who won twice, he was very un-James-like in his behavior, his attitude, because he was tired. So we're going to manage that a little better now that we've had 2 months to rejuvenate.
So what's your favorite part of your job?
The best part of the job is watching humans grow. And it happens, it's like having kids, I suppose. It happens so subtly that every year or so you kind of check in. Like, wow, has that kid come a long ways in a year? Because while you're in the middle of the battle, you know, you don't really notice it. You're like, Troy Taylor doesn't eat vegetables. He's one of the greatest kids. Won't eat a vegetable. And every day you're battling that. Hey, Troy, you need to go to sleep. You need to eat a vegetable. Well, he's unbelievably more mature as a human being and ready for life than he was a year ago. But I'm still on the vegetable kick. I try, you know. So, one, watching humans grow into fathers, husbands is the best part of the job. But, you know, secondly is the energy, the passion that I feel as golf coach from getting to spend time with all our department's great supporters. You know, when you come to work every day and there's people who are CEOs and business leaders and entrepreneurs and all these things our supporters and fans are, and they think your job's cooler than theirs, there's energy that comes with that, right? You know, they want to sit around on an hour phone call while they're running a 1,500-person company and talk about my team. If that doesn't energize you, I don't know what does. So those two things are kind of what drive me every day.
And what are your favorite things to do when you're not coaching golf and you're just you know, what do you like to do in your free time?
Well, boss, you've kind of hit one of my things I'm working on. Golfers generally don't have a lot of hobbies. And I decided at 38 years old, and I have two kids, which are absolutely the best thing in the world. That's what I love to do. But I don't have any personal hobbies, so I'm trying to create some, trying to do something new. Because, you know, we all spend our whole lives consumed in this game. I had a quiet fall. What did I do? I scheduled 5 trips to go out and watch our tour player play more golf. So I'm coming up with some hobbies, but, you know, other than raising my kids and being active in my community, I don't do a lot besides play golf.
Well, you're a great student of history.
Yeah.
So any interesting reading of late?
Well, I've been pretty locked in on so my daughter, she's 9, she's a presidential historian like her father. We talk about all the presidents. I've been pretty locked in on rereading John Adams by David McCulloch. It's just my favorite of all time because he was a short, somewhat grumpy, somewhat ornery brilliant leader.
So I went some analogies.
Yeah, yeah,
here.
The brilliant part I missed, but I like the underdog role of him, you know. So that's where I've been at lately. But her and I are always studying the same president at the same time.
Very cool. Very cool.
It's cool. I was curious. Do people still come up and recognize you from being on Big Break on
yeah,
the Golf Channel?
Not as much. You know, it's certainly something that, you know, if you're in a very golf nerd centric crowd, they'll know right away. They might not remember who you are, but the face is familiar. It wasn't my favorite thing I've ever done in life, so I don't bring it out that often. I remember my former sport administrator, Greg Ianni, he would always say, "You got to talk about that more often." I was on a reality TV show. I don't know how you talk about that in a positive setting. But I think one of the things that as we travel this country, it's amazing how many people know who we are as coaches. 600,000 alums or whatever there is. It feels like that is way more prevalent. You know, and
great.
We always travel with a bag tag. It says like men's golf head coach on my backpack. Every time I'm sitting on an airplane, that creates 30 minutes of conversation. And when I was growing up, or even when I got the job, I didn't really think golf coaching would be that cool to so many people. So more people recognize the work we do at Michigan State, which is cool.
Casey Luban, head men's golf coach at Michigan State University. And as we've learned today, there's a lot to being a golf coach that's more than coaching golf. You've built an incredible program here, as
you
said, four NCAA tournaments. We're looking for a fifth this year. You've graduated some very strong and successful young men who've gone out into the world and represented not only your program, but our university with great pride. And so thank you for all you do for men's golf, for MSU athletics, and more importantly, for Michigan State University.
Well,
great to have you on the program
thank
today.
Thank you. It's the honor of my life.